I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania spends about $2 billion a year on corrections, on the 50,000 people in state prisons, the roughly 2,000 in local jails, and the hundreds of thousands who are on parole or probation. About 60% of inmates who are released are rearrested or end up back behind bars within a year. That's according to the Department of Corrections. Well, Pennsylvania is increasingly relying on risk assessment tools, on things like computer algorithms to determine parole and probation, even sentencing decisions to predict criminal behavior to save money and slow the recidivism rate. Critics are worried that these tools may be racially biased and unfair, and that's our topic for today's Radio Times. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Richard Burke is a professor in the Department of Criminology, also in the Department of Statistics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's developed recidivism forecasting tools currently used by the Philadelphia Adult Department of Probation and Parole, the Pennsylvania Board of Probation and Parole, the Maryland Department of Corrections, and the California Department of Corrections. He's also working on developing forecasting procedures for the Philadelphia Police Department and pretrial processing in Philadelphia and the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing. Very long introduction. Richard Burke, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure to be here. I hope I can clear up some confusion.
Absolutely. And we will pick up on that. Let me introduce our second guest. Paul Hetznecker is a criminal defense attorney, former public defender, and he's a member of the board of directors for the Defender Association of Philadelphia, and he's an adjunct professor in criminal justice at Arcadia University. And Paul Hetznecker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here, Mark.
Nice to have you both with us. This is such a provocative and important topic. Let me begin with you, if I could, Richard Burke. We're talking about machine learning. We're talking about using data, I guess feeding that data into these computers. What is the data that you are working with?
It really depends upon the setting. The idea is to use whatever is routinely available. So you train the algorithm on all the information you can get. Once the algorithm is trained sufficiently, you're then prepared in the future to make forecasts as cases come in when you don't know what the outcome is.
So you're looking at things like where someone's zip code, for instance, the age of someone. Give us some specifics.
Well, it really depends upon the setting again. Generally speaking, we don't use race. We don't use zip code. We give up some accuracy if we do that, but that seems to be the feeling these days. And then the rest of the indicators are conventional measures of performance, rearrest rates, performance in prison, the age at which somebody committed their first offense, how recent their offenses are, things that everybody knows should be included.
And what's the goal?
There are two goals. The first goal is to improve the accuracy of forecasts so that when we make decisions, we make fewer mistakes. The second thing is we hope to make the criminal justice system more fair. There are important trade-offs between those two, but those are the two major goals.
And what has been the accuracy of the data that you have given to these various departments to use?
It's really hard to be specific, again, without talking about the setting. But I think the bottom line is we're much more accurate than existing decisions that are made.
Made by judges, I guess.
Made by judges.
Or parole boards.
Or parole boards, or sometimes by parole officers, probation officers, whoever the decision maker happens to be.
And better predicting in what way?
We make fewer mistakes. There's two kinds of mistakes. You can incorrectly say someone is high risk. You can incorrectly say somebody is low risk. Both of those mistakes are reduced with these procedures.
And reduced precipitously, dramatically, measurably? In what way?
Measurably, demonstrably, and then it depends upon your benchmark. We just finished an analysis of the reduction in crime around the state of Pennsylvania as the parole board started to use these tools. Violent crime is down by 20-25%. Nonviolent crime is about 30% down.
And you think it's because of this data, the use of this data?
That's where the weight of the evidence is. We always have to be cautious, but that's certainly where the weight of the evidence is at this moment.
Paul, let me get you in on the conversation. I wanted to make sure our listeners understand a little bit of what we're talking about. What are your concerns?
I think it's a very, very dangerous development. Certainly, social science can inform and has informed the criminal justice system for decades. The problem with the risk assessment is essentially it's a computer-driven algorithm that profiles. It relies on facts that are already within the system that we understand over 40 years of research are racially biased and class biased factors. So to say that we're not going to look at zip code, we're not going to look at race, it really undermines or really disguises what's really going on, and that is essentially crafting an algorithm based on information that the courts already recognize and social science already recognize are factors that reflect racial bias and class bias within our system, such as...
Give us an example.
Well, unemployment, educational deficits, the peer relationships. If we have individuals that are assessed based on their association and peer group, which some of these risk assessments do, we have a very dangerous development, which is where sentencing people – we'll start with sentencing. We'll get to bail in a moment because there are many, many more dangerous aspects of a bail project that relies upon it. But if we talk about sentencing, we're essentially relying upon these algorithms to produce, based on racially biased and class biased factors, to produce some – sense of future criminal conduct. That's not the purpose of what we should be doing in the criminal justice system, nor it has it been traditionally. Social science can inform, and we can certainly use social science to provide assessments for needs and treatment, but to turn essentially this risk assessment into a way in which we further incarcerate or place whole groups of individuals and sentence individuals based on group assessments is a very dangerous development that not only undermines the Constitution, but it undermines the principles that we hopefully hold true to our system of criminal justice, and that is equality and justice for all and not for certain segments of the population based on disparities.
But do you believe that judges are unbiased when it comes to things like someone's employment or unemployment record, their education, probably their race, they're standing in front of them?
Absolutely not. We've always, you know, we cannot cure the system of all racial and class bias, but what we can do in the form of advocacy provided by lawyers, provided by the defense attorneys, which are essentially the last sentinels of the Constitution, to stand there and put a check on the power of the state to jeopardize someone's liberty interest based on an algorithm that we can't reach. So, for example, and let me just add one more point. Many of these factors are unreachable by the judge. Once you've essentially created the algorithm, you've deferred some of the other arguments that would be available to an advocate in the system based on individualized-based sentencing. For example, in Wisconsin, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, in the Loomis case, unfortunately, and to the detriment of fundamental due process rights, has allowed risk assessments to be used in sentencing. But in the process of doing so, in a 60-some-odd page opinion, they lay out the concerns about accuracy, the concerns about the lack of transparency on the factors that are presented. There are concerns about and these are instructions to the judges. They're essentially the Supreme Court of Wisconsin offering guidance to the judges in assessing or using this risk assessment. Concerns about racial disparity. Concerns about the fact that we already know that in one particular study that was done in Broward County, Florida, that of 10,000 probationers and parolees, that African Americans were four times more likely to be wrongly assessed as high risk.
Let me pick up on several things, and let me go back to you, Richard Burke. How, then, do you suggest that this data, these algorithms, be used? Is it the sort of Bible that would be used in a courtroom or in a probation hearing, for instance?
Yeah, this is an example of the confusions I talked about when we opened this session up. First of all, the baseline is current practice. You can't, on the one hand, condemn the criminal justice system for inefficiency and bias and then stand in the way of innovations that could help. Second of all, the goal is not perfection. We're trying to do better. What's not to like? We should be able to do better. Third, judges use the same information and the same basic actuarial process that the algorithm does. You can't read the mind of a judge. Judge's mind is not transparent, and yet they nail our algorithms for not being transparent, where anybody can sit down and read the code. There are a whole bunch of other issues like that that somehow get confused, and so we don't really talk to one another. We talk past one another.
So as far as you're concerned, I'm trying to imagine, let's say, a judge or a probation hearing, for instance. How, then, do you suggest this information be used in determining either a sentence or someone's condition of parole or probation?
The same way this information has been used in the United States since the 1920s. This is not new. All we're talking about is providing another source to decision makers, which we help improve their ability to assess risk. They're the ultimate deciders, not the algorithm. It's just information. There's really nothing new here, but that is another confusion that gets us talking past each other.
Paul, he's saying, and I don't need to tell you, you're sitting right next to each other, that this is just information. This is data that can be used and that a judge perhaps has some degree of discretion. Yes, no?
No, it's unfortunately, it's a Trojan horse. It's essentially allowing the racially based and class-based factors which go into this algorithm to further drive institutional racism. That's not reform. That's not criminal justice reform. Criminal justice reform is looking for alternatives to incarceration, looking for diversionary programs pretrial, looking for treatment programs and reintegration programs post-trial and post-sentencing and post-incarceration. What the algorithm does by its very nature is essentially allows for all the existing factors that we've known since the 1960s and 70s that imbue the system with racism to be now incorporated in a way which then generates allegedly rationally based decision-making, fact-based decision-making by the judge.
Couldn't it be used for, let's say, someone deciding that they're actually low risk based on all this data, all these algorithms, someone who peers before a judge, if you run the data, turns out perhaps they are low risk for recidivism, for instance. Could it be used that way?
It could be. The problem is that it's what the studies have shown is that a high-risk individual could be an 18-year-old with no prior contact with the system, first-time offender, 18-year-old with no employment history, first-time offense. In some algorithms, that's a high-risk individual because of age and lack of employment. And then zip code becomes a factor. So when you profile early in the process, with the policing process, with the charging process, you essentially look at criminal history, which is one of the factors that these algorithms consider, you're eliminating all of the social science that says this has been race-based and economically uneven and unequal for four decades. And that's not reform. That's not reform. That reinstitutionalizes those concerns that we've had in the criminal justice system that make the system unequal.
About a minute before our break. Go ahead,
Richard Berg. More confusion. In fact, here in Philadelphia, what we learned was that a substantial number of individuals on probation could in fact be supervised hardly at all, precisely for the reason you described. They're low risk. Yes, some individuals are singled out as high risk, but enormous numbers of individuals are singled out as low risk precisely because most people are low risk.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about an important, potentially complicated, but I think you're beginning to see two sides of this debate about prediction algorithms used in the criminal justice system. And again, our guests are Richard Berg. He's a professor in the Department of Criminology and the Department of Statistics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's been developing some of these recidivism forecasting tools. Also with us is Paul Hetzniker, criminal defense attorney, former public defender, member of the board of directors for the Defender Association of Philadelphia, and an adjunct professor in criminal justice at Arcadia University. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Let me just recap here. The criminal justice system is increasingly turning to data, to algorithms, to decide things like sentencing and parole, saying they are more reliable. Critics are arguing that these crime forecasting tools may be racially biased and inherently unfair. Those are the two positions that you're hearing here on Radio Times. Richard Berg, let me go back to you. One of the criticisms I read was that it treats an individual as if they were a group. That individuals, I mean, a lot of behavior is predictable, but not everyone who maybe fits the criteria for being high risk is going to turn out to be a high risk, either inmate or someone who is released from prison. How do you factor that?
Of course. But the same is true of judges and magistrates who make decisions. So there's an individual who's convicted of a crime. The judge looks at the individual and says, gee, I've seen lots of people like this over my 20 years on the bench. People like this, pretty good risk. I'm going to give this person probation. Or the reverse. Judges do actuarial stuff all the time. They've done it since the beginning of our democracy. There's nothing new here. It just turns out that we're doing it more numerically But the process is the same. It's actuarial.
But if you do it numerically, I mean, you are, I mean, this is what statistics does, obviously treating people in terms of numbers. I guess it's just trying to figure out for that individual who's going to defy the algorithms.
Same is true of judges. They don't make every call exactly right. They make mistakes because they assume that this particular person in front of them is like or not like others they've seen before. Everything is compared to what? And judges do it, and so do the algorithms.
But you're saying this is what judges have done all along. This just kind of encapsulates it in a tool.
That's right. And it makes it more transparent, which is one of the great concerns. You can look at the algorithm and see what's happening. You can't look into the judge's brain and figure out what the judge did.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things, and I'll go back to you, Paul. In terms of what Richard Burke described, he said, we're not using, at least in Philadelphia, we're not using zip codes. We're not using race. Does that change your argument?
No, it's funny that he mentions the algorithms have been used since the 1920s, and that's accurate. In fact, the origins of the algorithms used in criminology were essentially race-based and based on nationality. In fact, some of the first studies, Professor Burgess, I think, did one of the first studies in which it was employed in sentencing or in parolee considerations. And race and nationality were a key factor in determining whether or not someone was paroled. What we have is in the 1970s, we have the criminal history as a proxy for race. For example, from 2001 to 2010, we had over 660,000 arrests for marijuana possession in this country. We spent $10 billion prosecuting those cases. Now, according to Professor Burke's algorithm, those marijuana cases, now in the states of Colorado, possibly, or Washington, or any other state that's now legalized marijuana use, personal use, those criminal history points, those categories, those factors are still incorporated into the algorithm. And more importantly, Richard Burke is absolutely wrong about sentencing structure. A judge cannot rely upon arrests as a basis for the sentencing. They can refer to them, but we presume those individuals arrested but not adjudicated guilty as innocent even throughout the system. So though courts can rely upon the fact that there's a criminal history, they cannot base a sentence on arrests. With the algorithm, it does just the opposite. It would incorporate the marijuana arrest, the minor possession. And by the way, African Americans, even in the city of Philadelphia, according to the ACLU, are three times more likely over the course of decades to have been arrested and charged with marijuana possession. So there's the racially disparate factor that's prevalent in all of these assessments, but now they're hidden. So I can't stand in front of a judge and say, by the way, judge, I'm going to remind you that the arrests that my client has cannot be factored into your determination of sentencing, and the judge recognizes that.
Well, let me go back.
Not with the algorithm. I'm sorry.
Let me go back to you, Richard Burke, then. Does your data treat all arrests equally?
Of course not. This is just confusion everywhere. First of all, we update the algorithm as statutory settings change. And yes, things do change, and we have to take it into account. The second thing, as I've said it now several times, these sentences are not determined by the algorithm. This is just another source of information. Judges can choose to ignore it if they wish or rely on it if they wish. There's no requirement.
I think one of the questions is, can you have fairness and accuracy when it comes to sentencing or probation and all that? Let me toss that first to you, Richard Burke.
The answer, unfortunately, is no, and that's a point I wanted to get to. We're faced with a variety of very difficult trade-offs when we try to get a system that is absolutely race neutral and absolutely accurate. You can't expect these algorithms to erase 300 years of racial injustice. But we hope we can do better, and there is evidence that we are doing better and no evidence that we're doing worse unless you pick really crappy algorithms, which is what happened in Wisconsin.
And you're saying they are really crappy.
They are really crappy. No serious computer scientist or statistician takes those algorithms seriously. Moreover, it's proprietary. So Paul's absolutely right. We can't tell what's going on, but that's a problem with the proprietary algorithm. It's not a problem of algorithms in general.
Are there good algorithms, bad algorithms from your perspective, Paul Hitzinger?
I think the algorithms can inform in terms of treatment, and I think that's the distinction. See, here's the focus and the goal here with these algorithms. It's to incarcerate. It's to further incarcerate and or make a determination about whether someone should be incarcerated or not, if we're talking about the notion of low risk. For example, if we have the notion that somehow race-based decision-making is excluded or somehow limited, that's a fallacy. What happens is if we've had 300 years of racially disparate and racist institutions, and we take the factors that reflect those existing racist institutions, how is it we're eliminating racial discrimination? We're not. We're not. We take essentially the same factors, and from what my understanding with respect to the current MacArthur proposal, I'm not even sure what factors the professor is going to offer in terms of bail assessments, and we'll get to bail in a moment. But you can't eliminate the race-based factors. Essentially, how do you factor in whether or not a police officer had wrongly charged or a person had been wrongly arrested based on race and then brought into the system and wrongly convicted? We can't do that with the algorithm.
Yes,
we can do that. No, we can't do it. Because what we've done is we've essentially said once the conviction happens, then that conviction then becomes part of it. Mm. Who is going to identify that other than the person who's been wrongfully convicted, that was a wrongful conviction in my past, 20, 30 years or 2 years ago?
Richard Burke, go ahead and then I'm back to you.
My goodness, this is frustrating. We have algorithms that, in fact, adjust for this stuff. They're not perfect. He laughs because he's ignorant. The fact of the matter is
we have
algorithms.
I don't think he's ignorant. He has a difference of opinion. I'm just going to correct
you.
Well,
I ask him to read the literature on this, and he will see that there are algorithms that correct. They're not perfect, but they get back to the issue you raised before about trade-offs. If you want a totally race-neutral algorithm, there will be more crimes that could have been prevented that we're not going to be able to prevent. I saw in the paper this morning a couple of people shot, a couple of people beat up downtown. Where were the victims in this discussion? They count too.
Hmm. But I mean, what you're saying is that race is a factor in crime,
which makes it racist.
Well, go ahead.
So is gender. Everything we do was related to race and gender. If you want to eliminate the relationship between gender and race to anything, you're going to pay a price if you want more accuracy. That's the way the world is.
But let me ask you, Paul, and we'll get to some more of your criticism, but what would be – I think we can all agree that there's racism built into our criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
If not algorithms, what would address that?
The reforms in the criminal justice system are multi-level. Number one, we need to have treatment programs, employment programs. We need to stop incarcerating on a mass level whole generations of young African-American and Latino men. That's number one. So we need to adjust our political decision-making regarding what the long-term goals should be of the criminal justice system. We need to provide treatment programs, educational programs, job placement programs. That's where the resources should go, not in developing an algorithm that's going to reinforce the race-based disparities that already exist. That's ignorance. Hmm. And that's ignorance of 40 years of social science that has established that the system is inherently racist. That is ignorance.
I certainly agree that we have too many people incarcerated, that the criminal justice system makes mistakes. We're 100% agreement on that. And the reforms that he suggests are probably a good idea. And let me go back to what I said before. Okay. Often what these algorithms do is reduce the punitiveness of the system for people who are low risk. Certainly he would like that. And that's often what these algorithms do. In fact, as I said, in Philadelphia, that's one of the key findings from the application in the Adult Department of Probation and Parole.
We don't need an algorithm to do that. We can do so based on principles of equality and justice. We can do so based on the social science that says we're not providing the resources for drug treatment, job training, and job placement that need to be there. We don't need an algorithm to tell us that. The algorithm does the opposite. It reinforces the old factors.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Paul Hetzenegger. He's a criminal defense attorney, former public defender, in fact, a member of the board of directors for the Defender Association of Philadelphia. Richard Burke, professor in the Department of both Criminology and Statistics at the University of Pennsylvania, and he has developed recidivism forecasting tools. That's what we're talking about, debating the use of these prediction algorithms when it comes to criminal justice. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Richard Burke, let me go back to you. I do want to get some folks in on the conversation, but go back to you. One of the other criticisms I read about these algorithms is that it basically, especially if someone is considered high risk, that it punishes them for some future crime that they might commit, the kind of minority report view of using algorithms and this kind of data. What is your response to that?
That issue is above my pay grade because we, in fact, do that all the time. Future dangerousness is something that's required to be assessed, for example, in our bail decisions. It's built into our sentencing as well. Future dangerousness, public safety are built in. Whether that is unconstitutional or immoral, I'll turn to people who study that.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand. It's easy to understand what's going on. But again, it's pervasive already.
Future dangerousness. Go ahead.
Paul. This strikes at the very heart of our criminal justice system. What provides us the protections and the freedoms in our democracy is the ability to move without encumbrance, without any interference by the state. Once you get arrested, once you're pulled within the system, then those constitutional due process protections provide essentially the bulwark against the police state. And that's exactly what's at the heart of our democracy. So when you start to blur those lines and say we're going to predict future dangerousness at a bail hearing, essentially predetermination at a bail hearing that someone's future dangerousness is at stake before they've ever been had any of the full panoply of due process rights availed to them, that's a real dangerous incursion on our overall system, and it's an erosion of those constitutional rights. And let me just provide just a brief
sure,
overview.
And then I'll go back to you, Richard.
The presumption of innocence is key in our system of criminal justice. And this erodes the presumption of innocence. This has long been a debate in the federal system, and I practice in the federal system. You know, the Bail Reform Act was passed in 1984, and the criticisms, including from staunch Dixiecrats like Senator Sam Ervin, said this would undermine the presumption of innocence. It would deprive a defendant's right and access to a viable defense. And it essentially replaces the presumption of dangerousness with the presumption of innocence with the presumption of dangerousness, which erodes from the very beginning that individual's rights. And I can go in on detail, but I'll give an example. So the statistics show that a person who's held without bail based on either risk of flight or danger, and I think risk of flight is a legitimate concern that
right.
any bail consideration, any court, any bail commissioner should consider, any magistrate. But once you make a determination based on dangerousness, the individual that's now incarcerated pretrial is more likely to accept a deal at a higher charge just to get out of jail, is more likely, based on the statistics, to spend more time in jail. And because you spend more time in jail, the impact of that is long-term because you're more likely to be a recidivist if you spend a longer period of time in jail.
You're saying it kind of creates a circular...
It creates a domino effect of all the rights and essentially all the things that we're trying to protect against with the due process protections.
Go ahead, Richard Burke.
But what about all the people who would have been put in jail at their arraignment who now are not because the algorithm, in fact, shows them to be low risk?
We don't need a risk assessment for that. We can do it without.
I have data if I can just get it
go
out.
Ahead,
okay?
Go ahead.
We can compare the accuracy of the algorithm, let's say, in domestic violence cases here in Philadelphia against the decisions already made by the judges. If our algorithm would be implemented, and this is a peer-reviewed piece you can look at, we could probably reduce by over 1,000 the number of domestic violence arrests or at least events that are recorded by the police. That's 1,000 victims. There is real risk out there. Similarly, we can reduce the number of individuals who pose no risk. So we can reduce domestic violence and we can have fewer people incorrectly incarcerated. Again, what's not to like?
Hmm. That same rationale
go
undermines.
Ahead, and then we'll get some callers in. No, go ahead.
The
go
same
ahead.
Rationale point. Undermines essentially the protections provided by the criminal justice system. With that same rationale, we could profile everybody, whether they're charged or not. We could profile everybody and essentially determine the risk of dangerousness. That's exactly the kind of erosion I'm talking about. What protects our freedoms and protects our democracy is the right to be free from this kind of predetermination, which he's talking about. And the algorithm at a bail hearing does exactly that. We can provide no cash bail for low-risk offenders. We don't need an algorithm for that.
But what I also hear Richard Burke say, Paul Hetzinger, is think about the victims. I mean, if as we use this data, think about their safety or maybe even their future safety.
And that's a concern that the judge makes at sentencing. But we don't make that pretrial unless we have some fact-based reason to employ a protective order, which is already in place, or a stay-away order, which we can already do. We don't jeopardize somebody's liberty interest simply on the mantle of the what appears to be the only primary goal of these algorithms, which is the safety of the community, essentially deriding every protection for the criminal defendant charged in the system.
Let me get Carol from Wilmington to join our conversation. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
What this reminds me of, it reminds me of two things. The first thing it reminds me of is the mandatory sentencing minimums they had back in the 90s where they wanted to take away the bias of the judges. And they put all of this mandatory sentencing in place. And one of the things, they didn't put race around that, but an example of what they did that biased that system was they said that cocaine and crack were treated differently, which treats crimes that happen in different communities differently in their algorithm, which caused rates of imprisonment to skyrocket. And not once did we stop and check our system, because once you attach yourself to a system, it's very hard to step in and check it and say that this is going terribly wrong.
You know what,
in the
Carol,
wrong direction.
Carol, only because I'm looking at the clock here, and I do want to give Richard Burke a chance to respond to your comments, and I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. She raises an interesting point.
Yeah, that history is absolutely right, up to a point. It certainly is true that was a horrible mistake. I was actually involved in overseeing this U.S. Sentencing Commission as that was being discussed. And a lot of the concerns revolved around the fact that crack cocaine was associated with violent crime. That may have been misguided, but it wasn't evil. The consequences were unfortunate. And in fact, there have been challenges. I was involved in a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court challenging those 30 years, 25 years ago. So the challenges were there. It just has taken an unfortunately long time to straighten things out.
Almost up on a break here, Paul. Let me just give you a chance to do a quick response.
Carol makes an excellent point. That's precisely the concern here, is when we're now using a system that is based upon a notion of a group or a particular crime offense, and then employing a mandatory sentencing structure on it. And it's been failed. We know that. We know already with the Holder memo by Attorney General Holder that asks each individual U.S. attorney to look very carefully at those charged with mandatory minimums and determine whether or not they should be they should pursue the mandatory minimums on those cases. So Carol is absolutely correct. This is exactly the kind of concern that we should all have about the algorithm.
Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I see lots of people want to join it. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'll read a bunch of tweets and emails after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania is increasingly relying on risk assessment tools, on computer algorithms to determine parole and probation, even sentencing decisions, to predict criminal behavior, to save money, perhaps even slow the recidivism rate. But critics are worried that these tools may be racially biased and unfair. You're hearing those two perspectives from our guest, Paul Hetznecker, a criminal defense attorney, former public defender, member of the board of directors of the Defender Association of Philadelphia, Richard Burke, a professor in both the Department of Criminology and Statistics at the University of Pennsylvania. And he is developing some of these recidivism forecasting tools used here in Philadelphia, also in the state of Pennsylvania, Maryland, California, and more. 1-888-477-9499. Let me read some comments here. Disagree wholeheartedly with prediction algorithms. It gives judges justification for continued race and class. No, no, no. A comment from Royce. The idea of an individual's futures or relying upon algorithms makes me very nervous. A tweet from Mr. C. Proprietary. Where's the money coming from to fund the establishment and maintenance of these algorithms? Tweet from Dan. They're debating how to deal with bias observation data, which is all we can really use to build hashtag machine learning models. So kind of a sense of how listeners are thinking about some of this stuff. Let me get Marini from Philadelphia to join us. Marini, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, my dear. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm good. Go ahead, Marini.
You know, I will stop by a police officer somewhere in Northeast. I drive Uber part-time where I dropped a passenger, and I was looking for a way to 95. Suddenly, I'm the only black on the road. Suddenly, it's about like 9:30 in the evening. I saw a siren, so I pulled over, thinking that the police officer has an emergency. He pulled behind me, and I just lost it. I said, officer, why did you stop me? Because I knew I didn't do anything wrong. Why did you stop me? Twice I asked him. He said, well, he saw me changing lanes. I said, since when did it become a violation that you change lanes, and that's the reason why you stopped me. He said, yes. So I want to ask Professor, the professor.
Sure.
If I was put inside the arboretum and if he had arrested me, under what category would I have come up from?
Hmm. What he's saying, and I think you heard it, Richard Burke, is that he got pulled over by the cops, and he's drives a cab, concerned that he could be entered into the system for what appears to be no crime whatsoever.
It would depend upon a whole bunch of other factors, but there's nothing particularly weighty about that event. I agree it sounds unfair, no doubt. I'm sorry that it happened, for sure. But it wouldn't change the result of the algorithm very much.
Why not? Very much.
Well, because it takes into account a whole bunch of factors. We don't, by the way, we don't take education or employment or marital status or any of that stuff. But the factors we do take into account are many, and they're entered in very complicated ways. And that particular event is unlikely to have moved the dial whatsoever.
You're shaking your head, Paul.
I am. It's as I stated in the beginning of the program, this is computer-generated profiling. Let's talk about profiling. As the caller mentioned, in Philadelphia, subject to a settlement consent decree, the city of Philadelphia police department has been monitored for the last 6 years for racial profiling. So, for example, in 2010, 253,000 car stops resulted in Philadelphia. 72% were African-American, and only 8% resulted in a crime being charged. So what happens to the 230,000 people that are stopped for no reason or for very little reason? The loss of trust and faith and accountability is a key component in our criminal justice system reform. We need to re-emerge those principles of faith and trust. So, for example, 5 years later, 2014 or 15, the same data showed that it was 80% of the people stopped on pedestrians stops mm-hmm. by police were African American. We have the same results, no change. In order to change the way we assess the criminal justice system and reform, we have to start with the change in police policy. We have to get rid of stop and frisk as a basis for intersecting individuals that should never be in the system at all into the criminal justice system. And we need to essentially start with the notion that we have profiling existing at the front end, and that profiling continues and gets exacerbated throughout the entire system to sentencing, incarceration, and parole decisions. So we have to start with that notion. And those statistics scream out for reform. But it starts with reforming the police as an institution, police departments as institutions across this country, and it goes from there.
Mm. But what you're describing has nothing to do with algorithms.
No, it doesn't. But the algorithm, if in fact someone is arrested falsely and charged, or someone is essentially brought into the system wrongfully, that particular arrest and wrongful conviction may ultimately be part of that algorithm, and that's the concern. And more importantly, if we want to reduce recidivism, we don't need an algorithm to essentially determine low risk or high risk. What we need to do is build institutions that are going to establish the trust. For example, community policing. We need to enhance community policing. We need to enhance diversionary programs early on at the time that people are arrested. We need to essentially provide those institutional framework that offers real reform, treatment programs, education programs, and not simply algorithms that seek to incarcerate further.
Go ahead, Richard Burke.
Oh, basically, he's talking about fundamental reform that I would agree with. There's no disagreement. The question is, how do we get there in the meantime? It may take a decade or more to get some of these programs up and running. In fact, we don't know what works. There's really very little science behind this. The social science is very weak. In the meantime, can we improve current practice? That's all we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Less bias, more accuracy. Yes, it's not perfect. It's not a reform of the whole system, but it seems to me a step in the right direction. Think of the victims who are better off. Think of the individuals who would have been incarcerated who will not be incarcerated now because of the algorithm. Think of the individuals who are taking drug treatment, alcohol treatment, who wouldn't have been were it not for the algorithm. The emphasis on all the ugly things seems to me to distort the discussion.
Well, we do know it works. For example, in the city of Philadelphia, there was a pilot project based on a study done in 2007 regarding recidivism among juveniles and disciplinary infractions among juveniles. And so, for example, if we talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, which is essentially the beginning of a lot of the social dysfunction that we see, the effort to decriminalize rather than criminalize small disciplinary infractions, to create youth panels and discussion panels with those youth that are charged with those infractions, rather than referring them to police. There was a 54% reduction in the number of arrests, and that's significant. We do have the stats. If we start out with the notion that we can build restorative justice models as an alternative to incarceration, we don't need an algorithm.
Let me ask you, I'm going back to you, Paul. We did a show a couple of years ago about an effort here in Philadelphia to look at really high-risk criminal population responsible for much of certainly the violent crime in Philadelphia, and really targeting them and trying to really focus on what their behavior in the community, perhaps even their behavior within the criminal justice system. What is the difference between that? I mean, seeing that they're high, that probably fit Richard's profile for a high-risk person. What is the difference between that and what he's talking about in terms of algorithms?
Well, I think the underlying premise is selective incapacitation, and that whole notion of selective incapacitation is a grave concern, because if you're having essentially the police do the functioning of looking for individuals that they determine are high-risk, rather than providing programs that would divert that high-risk individual into a more positive direction, that should be the direction of the social science and of criminal justice reform, not further policing, not further labeling and designating people as high risk and then acting and having police intervene based on that. We need to divert them in a more positive direction by providing community-based programs. Mm-hmm. And this diversionary program at the school is an example of a successful one.
Richard Burke?
I don't disagree with that. That's what the algorithms can do. We're trying to separate those folks who pose a serious threat to public safety, where the victims will often be from the same communities these individuals come from what we think is the majority, who are good risks and would benefit enormously from the programs that Paul is describing. There's no disagreement.
And that's what I said, the difference between treatment as opposed to a punitive measure and allowing an algorithm to have some benefit. But that would be post-trial, post-sentencing, possibly parole decisions, or not decisions, but parole programs for individuals or probationary programs based on treatment and not punishment.
What do you think about that?
Well, that's exactly what we've done. There's published articles on this in the case of pretrial. We have lots of proposals for the low-risk folks for DV. There are programs that might work. I'm not as sanguine about what we know. Mm-hmm. When I read it, I'm not as convinced. But there's promise there. And we find the low-risk folks, there's lots of them, and provide those services that Paul's describing. There's no disagreement. But we got to know who they are. He claims we know already. The evidence contradicts that definitively.
No.
Let me get some callers in. No, I appreciate that. I think we've got, looks like Dan. Dan from Philadelphia. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I'm a data scientist working in healthcare, and we don't use just one specific model or one type of model in our work that we do. We have a series of models that we use. So my question was for Richard Burke, do police departments use other types of models like likelihood to need a mental health care program for somebody or substance abuse, predicting substance abuse use to try and get people into different, maybe non-law enforcement related programs that they might need? Is there a more holistic or integrated approach to modeling?
Dan, I appreciate the call. That's to you, Richard.
Yes, absolutely. The question is how fast this technology can evolve to address these complicated problems. But everybody understands exactly your point. There are a variety of things we need to be able to anticipate to make for better outcomes. So, yes, but again, it takes time to make all these reforms real.
That's not accurate at all. In fact, police departments are essentially paramilitary organizations. And if you use focused deterrence, which is one of the programs that is essentially based on some of this data, you're essentially harassing young men on the corner. You're undermining the trust that should be developed based on community policing and not harassment by police officers of young men that they've targeted. That's not purposeful. And we shouldn't be basing liberty interests, people's liberty interests, on an algorithm that essentially targets them and pre-designates them as dangerous before they ever get arrested.
But are you saying that the use of that algorithm is how police are operating in the streets?
Well, yeah, I'm not saying in Philadelphia. I'm not sure in Philadelphia. But that's the movement towards that direction, is that they create a paramilitary program. They look at the districts and essentially say, well, here's a high crime area. Let's go into that high crime area and be active in trying to prevent crime. And what does that mean? That's going to be – that doesn't mean community-based policing. It means stopping individuals and increasing the numbers of illegal stops and frisks that we've had that they've been denounced both in Philadelphia and New York City.
Richard Burke, let me go back to you. And I was reading in doing my homework for the show that you're working on some kind of predictive model looking at a newborn, when a newborn is born, to be and determining or trying to figure out if they will have committed a crime by the time they're 18 years old. Do I have that right?
You have that right. We've talked about that with some colleagues in Norway. It's no different from a medical intervention that you've just heard one of the callers speak about. We provide, ideally, nutrition, parent counseling, all sorts of beneficial daycare, preschool, because certain kids in certain households are at higher risk. Right now, we don't, unfortunately, have the resources for everybody, so we want to target the positive resources to the families most in need. We have to forecast which families are going to need that, so it's not some kind of horrible plot. And by the way, I'm not even sure we can do it. We're just talking about it at this point.
Okay, go ahead.
I have to respond. This is one of the most frightening dystopic prospects that we could imagine. We are now essentially taking the prison model and applying to everyone. We're essentially pre-designating. It's no different than this war on drugs morphed into the war on terror. We essentially identify an unidentifiable population. We try to identify them and then curb their behavior and to define an educational process based on some DNA extract and some statistical, you know, evaluation of that individual. It destroys freedom. It destroys the notion of free will. It undermines essentially all the protections that are provided under the First Amendment, our right to associate and be free from that kind of government intervention. It's exactly the kind of the extreme extension of rationalization, of using science to somehow control, use science as a method of social control. That's a very dangerous prospect. And that's what I said earlier. You take that prison model, you take that algorithm, and you apply it not just to parolees and to those who are sentenced. You now apply it to people who are just arrested. Oh, no, let's expand it beyond that. Let's expand it to everyone and create a database so that we can predict future behavior. That's not democracy.
Go ahead, Richard Burke.
What he's just done is throw out personalized medicine, for example, where we look and when women go in with a pregnancy, we check about various sorts of risks for birth defects based on genetics and examination of the fetus. He's throwing that out because, after all, we're prejudging it. It's an important additional piece of information for a pregnant woman to have. It's an important piece of additional information for a woman to have if it's not genetically based but still helps us anticipate what she needs positively. Nobody's talking about incarcerating anybody here. It keeps coming back to that. The point is to provide benefits.
Let me just toss it. We're almost out of time here. Let me just toss to you, though, Paul. But if you look at an infant born into a violent household, for instance, or a household where there's a great deal of chaos, we know that puts them at risk for difficulties in the future. I'm not saying crime, but they're going to have a difficult time dealing with some of the aspects of their lives.
And we put the social service resources into the money into social service resources and not prisons and not attempting to identify based on some algorithm whether or not someone is going to be a future criminal. That's dangerous. That's not democracy. That's totalitarianism. And that's the kind of the positivism, the science invading our system of justice and essentially undermining the pillars of due process that essentially protect us against a police state. And that's a dangerous prospect.
We're almost out of time. Just 10 seconds from you, Richard Burke.
It's very simple. Again, he keeps emphasizing these catastrophes. A lot of this has to do with positive things. If you set up the worst case scenario of a dystopia, well, everything is bad. And the point is these things can be used for good. It's not to say they shouldn't be carefully monitored, but they can be used for good, and they are being used for good.
We don't need it for social reform and for criminal justice reform. We just need the resources for the programs that are necessary to provide people what they need to essentially alter their lives.
Paul Hetznecker and Richard Burke, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. I know a difficult conversation, not much consensus here, but I think a chance for all of our listeners to get a sense, a flavor for this profound disagreement over the use of algorithms in predicting criminal behavior. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the program. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.